This is an interview with Dr. E. Harry Medlin on the 31st of August 2007 at Crafers West for the University of Adelaide Oral History. Interviewer Rob Lynn. Well, Harry, you were born in 1920 in Oraru to John and Myra Medlin?
Yes, yes.
So tell me a little bit about those early years at Oraru, please, Harry.
Well, it's a fascinating place, and it's marvellous to be brought up by a country woman in a country town. I went to school early. I was supposed to be a bit of a smart ass, I think, and I got put up two grades, like my wife. And in those days, that was a little bit unfunny, because bullying has always been, within my experience, the name of the game. And being able to come top of the class and being smaller than them, I was in terrible trouble. So I had to learn how to fight, and like the shearer's cook, you know. And my father taught me how to fight. You put your thumb inside a clenched fist so that you don't break it off, and you hit straight, and you imagine that you... This is good physics. You imagine that you're going to hit the back of the head, but you hit the nose. And just as you hit the nose, you turn your fist. And even though I was a little kid, I won every fight, and finally they left me alone. But I got a beautiful education in Oraru, especially in the English language. We had to do, and perhaps you did too, parsing and analysis. We had books. We did grammar. We learned syntax. We learned punctuation. We learned to know what a gerund was. We knew the moods of the English language. We learnt the proper use of prepositions. And if I ever said or wrote different to, I don't think I would have survived.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Harry.
It was different exactly. From. So that was our... We learned how to survive in the bush. We learned how to scrounge. We learned how to avoid those deadly scorpions.
Yeah.
We learned how to catch snakes, especially if they were hiding in rabbit burrows. We had... those animals that go... Well, I've forgotten what they call those animals that go down the burrows and drive the rabbits. And
ferrets.
The ferrets. You have to be very careful, because the ferrets... You have to plot the rabbit warren before you put the ferret in, otherwise you might lose it because it'd come up somewhere else. We did learn to survive in the bush, and we learned where every... Kwandong tree was around Oraru. We could find all the Kwandongs. And when our kids were young, Dottie and I used to take our kids up there and let them loose in the bush, and that'd have been lost within a nanosecond. I'm reminded of the stories. In fact, a distant relative of mine wrote a book about early settlement in South Australia and the Bay Road. Now, it's always been the Bay Road, as far as I'm concerned, when they called it Anzac Highway in 1936, but the Bay Road. Now, if they wanted a wee or something, they'd go into the Black Forest, and it was a Black Forest, and they'd get lost, of course, because the moss was on the wrong side of the stump, and a lot of people died off the Bay Road. So as a country boy, as I say, we learned how to survive in the bush.
What was your father's occupation up there, Harry?
He was a plumber and tinsmith. He served his trade there, and he was a tradesman, but he was also a bandsman, because every country boy was in the band, and Dad played the bugle and the cornet and the trumpet. And when he joined the 43rd Battalion, he became in the band. He became a stretcher bearer. Mm. Which is one of the most dangerous, the most dangerous occupation. But after the war, and he went back. He went back to his trade and became a plumber.
He was wounded during the war, wasn't he? Gassed, is that right?
Yes, he was. He was wounded several times. He went to England once on they called it a blighty after a stunt. I'm not too sure what happened in the stunt. But he was certainly wounded in August of 1918, which is that famous day described in the myriad faces of war. that famous day when the Canadians and the Australians broke through the German lines and set it up for armistice. So he was, yes, he was seriously wounded, and he had sciatica for the rest of his life, and so that's why we came to Adelaide, so that he could get treatment. I think that was about 1930.
So you spent the first 10 years at Oraru.
Yeah.
Where did you live when you came to Adelaide?
My mother came from an extended family at Mount Barker. She had, there'd been 13 siblings, one died, there were 12. Seven of them girls and five boys. So there were no telephones, of course, but there were cable contacts. And one of my other sisters got a place for us at Henley Beach. Mm. And we moved onto the Esplanade at Henley Beach, just near, just along a couple of blocks from Del Monte.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, that would have been beautiful then.
Yeah, it was. It was glorious.
Yeah. So did your children, even though you loved the bush, did you find you loved the seaside as well?
You quick and lively adapt to a different environment. And at one stage, we actually went to Blackwood, because one of my mother's brothers, who'd been in the 43rd Battalion with my father, had a house there, and he became a driver for the repatriation department. Mm. And people lived at Belair and Blackwood, the people who had tuberculosis. Mm. In fact, Bel Air comes from the French La Belle Air, and they had a hostel at Angarichina, Parachuna, and he used to drive people up to the hostel. And so they were away at times, and we moved into their house at Blackwood, Brighton Parade, Blackwood. So my schooling, my primary schooling was very, very disorganised.
How did you end up at Adelaide Technical High School, Harry?
Well, we went back from Blackwood to Henley Beach, and a cousin of mine, one of my mother's sister's daughters, had done very well in what used to be called the qualifying certificate, the QC, which you did at the end of primary school, year seven. I think she got something like 679 out of 700, which was quite remarkable. Mm. And because I'd done fairly well at school, my mother was encouraged to aim me to get to Adelaide Tech. And I sat for the examination and I got in. Actually, I didn't do terribly well. In fact, I believe I got robbed, because there were 700 marks and 200 of them were for arithmetic, and I claim that I got the whole paper right, but I only got 170 out of 200 from Henley Beach. But nevertheless, I was the last admitted to Adelaide Tech, but I came ducks in my class, so I beat all these kids from Rose Park and the Grange. He'd beaten me in the QC. That's how I got in there. It was an incredible school.
That's what I wanted to ask you. What type of school was it?
It was run by Methodists. And I was brought up a Methodist, so I understand them. And you were not allowed to talk to the girls. Now, there were two divisions. The technical side was only for boys. The commercial side was essentially for girls. But there were a number of boys who were able to get into the commercial side. They could talk to the girls, but we were not allowed to talk to the girls, even though we might be from the same Methodist church, which after we moved to Crowder Park, we attended the Methodist church at Keswick, mm-hmm. and there was a girl there called Yvonne Dunk, and I knew her quite well, but I wasn't allowed to talk to her as a girl at Adelaide Tech. The other thing, do you know the School of Mines?
Yes.
You know the Brookman Hall?
Yes.
Okay. There was a woman who ran a class of eurythmics. Her name eludes me at the moment. She ran this eurythmics class. And the girls would put on short dresses, and we would get up, and we would sneak into the balcony. And we were in terrible trouble if we were ever caught there. And Sid was, Siddy Moyle was the headman. He was a tyrant. And he caught a fellow once who was about 6 feet tall and actually beat him up. And I was surprised that the fellow didn't murder Sid. But But he is very respectful of authority, and he expected you to be respectful of him. For example, after the war, and when I was employed at the university, I used to be involved with the supervising public examinations. And on one occasion, down at the Centennial Hall, I was in charge of the invigilators, and who should be one of them but Sid? And he treated me very respectfully. Yes, Dr. Medlin. No, Dr. Medlin.
So the education as such there, though, Harry, was that of a high quality?
Yes, it was. Extremely high quality, and that's why I'm surprised that nobody went on to become Rhodes Scholars, because part of our education, I think I did 11 subjects in the intermediate. We had to do, for example, woodwork, fitting, turning, sheet metal work, all those extra things in addition to English, arithmetic, maths 1, maths 2, physics, chemistry, drawing. The standard was extremely high, and we used to saturate the credits in the public examinations board. But in addition, we had a subject there called civics.
Yes, yes.
Now, I might talk to my grandchildren about this and ask if they are educated to know this, the political structure of the country and the organisation of public services and facilities. We used to be taken to Parliament, to the Town Hall, to the Law Courts. And I remember once we were taken to the Law Courts and there was a bloke charged with murder. There was no examination in civics, but we were taught other things, like how to apply for a job. And this gives the Methodist tone of the place. You had to finish, "I beg to remain your humble servant." Well, Harry Medlin never, ever wrote such a letter, I promise you.
So Harry, that subject, civics, which is these days is a new subject, legal studies, it's become. It's been reintroduced. That was a mark of the breadth of education at Adelaide Tech then. You weren't just an academic place.
Oh, no, no. The school had an enormous reputation because I matriculated when I was 15 because I did intermediate French, and to matriculate you had to have a leaving certificate and the foreign language at least at intermediate level. So we were offered jobs. Now, you see, this was 1935, 1936. Now, it was the tail end of the Depression and there was a big unemployment problem. But these employers used to approach the school for recommendations, and I was recommended for one job, I remember, which I declined to take, and then I was recommended to be an apprentice at the then Adelaide Electric Supply Company. And just on the sheer recommendation of Adelaide Tech, three of us were appointed on the same day. And actually, we started work on the day that King George V died, in 1936.
So, Harry, were you working in the Kelvin building, not that far across the road from the school?
Well, I wish I had, but no, I was one of those who was sent to the service branch at Hilton.
Hilton.
Just opposite the Hilton Hotel. And the unfortunate part about that was that those of us who were there did not get time off during the day to go to the university or the School of Mines, whereas those who worked in the Kelvin building could, because they just nick across the road. And it wasn't until my fourth year there, that's 1939, that I got any time off at all and was therefore able to do Mathematics 1, which, although part of the Bachelor of Engineering / Fellowship of the South Australian School of Mines, the mathematics was given in the university, whereas all the subjects that I did for the FSISM were done at night and in the School of Mines. Now, the School of Mines essentially ran, as I say, this fellowship course, which, if you had matriculated, also got you the BE. Mm-hmm. But some subjects, like mathematics, were given at the university and were not night subjects or not evening subjects. So I could not do Maths 1 until 1939. And I was called up on the 3rd of September 1939. So I had to do the rest of the Mass 1 course by correspondence. But I think I got either the 4th or the 5th credit against all these full-time rich kids from St. Peter's College, including William Falling Scammell.
There's a name. So, yeah. Harry, tell me, although you said you couldn't take maths until 1939, had you managed to do night classes at the School of Mines prior to that?
I certainly did, because they expected we apprentices to work for the FSASM, and some of the more senior people at Hilton had completed their degrees that way. In 1936 and 37, I went 5 nights a week to night school at the School of Mines. Did subjects like Electrical Engineering 1, Electrical Engineering 2, Mechanical Engineering, Engineering Drawing and Design, Machine Design, Strength of Materials. So I completed about 12, I think, of the 26 subjects for the degree by going 5 nights a week, as I say, in 36 and 37. I joined the army in 38, so I kept one night for the army voluntary and compulsory parade, so I went 4 nights a week.
So when you say you joined the army, that is the militia?
Yeah.
So you would have been based at Keswick for that?
Yes, the engineers had a building and a parade ground right at the back. And by the back, I mean the furthest from the Bay Road, up against the railway line.
Yes,
you know the railway line runs past Keswick and it diverges. So the engineering establishment was right at the back, and we met once a week. Once a month was a compulsory parade, and you got 2 shillings. So we got 2 shillings a month because the voluntary parades were unpaid. Well, I attended the voluntary parades, as I say, so well, I had one night for the army. I worked quite hard.
I don't see where you had any spare time to speak of, Harry, because you would have been working Saturday mornings at least, as well as the weekdays.
We were, because when I started, it was the 44-hour week. Mm. At 8 hours on the first 5 days and 4 hours on Saturday morning. Mm. So, and then Sunday, of course, was for Methodism. But we did a lot on Saturday afternoons. I've always disliked competitive sport. No, I didn't phrase that correctly. I dislike the people who manage competitive sport. People like Arthur Tunstall. Mm. And the shocking way that he treated that Aboriginal girl. So, and I looked at bike riding. But I found that was pretty competitive and pretty dirty. So we rode it. We used to ride our bikes down to, even Victor Harbour, mm-hmm. And that was that old road, you know, nothing like that fancy road that kills people now. Ride our bikes down there chasing girls. But I might have said to you before, in my day, you couldn't catch any girls. You might be able to catch them now. I don't know, but you couldn't catch them then. But it was good fun trying.
Well, that life from your early years and teenage years, Harry, the way you're describing it, it's almost idyllic, or at least is a time of great enjoyment for you.
Well, it certainly was, and there were a complex of activities that I got involved in other things too in 1939. Well, the Methodists in those days had 2 youth activities, the Methodist Order of Knights for the boys and the Methodist Girls Comrades for the girls. Well, as a staunch Methodist, I joined the Methodist Order of Knights, And in 1939, I was a Knight Commander of the Keswick Methodist Order of Knights, and we actually won the Arthur Welch Shield for the best performed ritual group. I understand it was based on the Freemasons. The hall that we used to use was square, and they had had offices in different places, and people have told me that that was something like the way that Freemasons organised themselves. I wouldn't know, I learned all the ritual by heart, and as I say, we won the Arthur Welch Prize, the Shield Prize.
Now, Harry, returning to the School of Mines and Industries and that university site, can you describe, especially the university part, because you were involved there as a youth, can you describe for me what the university was like in the 1930s in a physical form?
Yeah, well, when it was established in 1874, of course, the Act of Parliament gave, I think, four acres, mm-hmm. and I think it was extended to five. I think by the time I went there, it had been extended, but not to the present extent of 30 or 35 acres or whatever it is, because the exhibition was out the back, and indeed the train to come to the exhibition building ran through what are now the cloisters of the Adelaide University Union. You see, those cloisters were not built until about the time that I went to the School of Mines. But when I was at school, as I say, the exhibition buildings were there. So it was pretty crummy. Out the back of the Worth Circus.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
They used to come and work there. Now, they were in this... I'm not too sure. It's probably where the engineering building is on the lower level. I know that we used to be able to crawl under the... under the tent and get in there things that we used to do. We crawled under there once and were faced with one of those huge Irish wolfhounds. Now, they're as big as ponies. So whether they knew that we were doing this and put the dog there or not, I wouldn't know. I take it when you say describe it, you mean the sociology of the place as much as the geography. The university was a place for the rich. Even about that time, the population was only some 2,000 or so, as I understand it. We did our mathematics in what is now the Mitchell Building. And in 1939, when I did mathematics, I used to be able to get off from Fort Largs to come to the tutorials. And there was a tutor there called Close. I think he was a high school teacher. I can still hear him saying to me, "Madeline, in mathematics, we have to work quickly and accurately." Well, I reckon I became a better mathematician than he ever did. But I never mixed really with the university students, because I was essentially from the School of Mines. Mm. And I think I might have said to you earlier that the union fee at the School of Mines was half a guinea, 10 and 6. And the union fee at the university was 3 guineas. Well, as an apprentice, in the first year I got 10 and 6 a week, the second year 15 shillings, the third year I think a guinea, and the fourth year, final year, 50 shillings, £2.10. So 3 guineas, a lot of money, and you need to be rich like William Fording Scammell and people like that. So for 10 and 6 we could play table tennis, the School of Mines, out the back of what is now, I think, the chemistry building.
at back of the exhibition building, Harry, were there sort of tears running down to the level where the Jubilee Oval was?
There must have been. I can't say that I recall that. I do recall that when we were at Adelaide Tech, we'd go down Frome Road. We had a sports field almost down to the zoo.
Yes.
And the river on the right-hand side, that's on the eastern side of yep. Frome Road. So we were aware of the exhibition building and the exhibition oval there, but were never really a part of it. That must have disappeared in the 36s, because the Lady Simon and George... Lady Simon Hall went up probably in the late 20s.
Yes, that's right. I think it was 28 or 9. I've got those dates.
Yeah, and the George Murray would have been after the Depression.
Correct,
about 36, 37. As I say, the open space between the Lady Simon and the George Murray used to be lawn. It's now paved over.
Mm.
And you can see that the field marks are where the train track used to be. I can't describe the embankment. I don't know the date of the steps that go down from the upper to the lower level. The Mrs. Waite, I think.
Yes.
Donated them. Well, that probably was... That could well have been post-depression. There might have been a mound.
The footbridge was 1919, from memory. And I think the stairs were late 30s, pretty much.
Yeah.
Mm. So,
there's a photo. I'll just chip in on you, Rob. There's a photograph of those stairs in the front cover, the dust cover of Margaret Finnis's The Lower Level.
Yeah.
And Jim Hyde, who was the...
Jim, yes. All hair.
A typical tide, he probably came down those steps about two or three at a time. His pose was... Jim Hyde. Yeah, I knew Jim quite well. And when we attended the first Adelaide Week in Penang, there was Eric Barnes, Harry Wesley Smith, Jim Hyde and Harry Medlin were university delegates. So Hyde I knew.
Mm.
Is he still around?
Haven't seen him for years, have
you?
No. I remember him very well. That's 30 years ago. No, 35 years ago.
He was a rebel, wasn't he?
He was.
Yeah.
As many were.
Yeah.
So, Harry, though, there was a strong connection between the Brookman Building and the university, as I've learned, that the two... places, while they were for different purposes, there was a connection between them. Were you aware of that?
Yes, and yes and no. There was a connection, and there was also, I think, an envy and a jealousy. The people like Brookman had been involved in both institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So had, of course, Langdon Parsons.
Benython?
Langdon Parsons Benython, or whatever. Yeah, Benython. In fact, the story as I remember it is that, because that's on Park Lands, the story as I remember it is that Benython put that there, started it, without any, the School of Mines, without any permission from the government or the city council or anybody. And the purpose, as I understood it, was to block Pulteney Street running straight through to the Torrens. So to get through to the Torrens, you had to turn right from Pulteney Street and go down the extension of Frome Street to Frome Road past the zoo. Anyway, whether that's true or false, I don't know, but it seems to make a bit of sense. I have an idea I read, perhaps it's in the lower level, perhaps Margaret Finnis unearthed that story, that the premier at the time that the building was opened congratulated Bonython or somebody on his initiative and lack of integrity.
So, Harry, your war years have been recorded elsewhere, but I'm wondering, prior to going to war, you'd started Mathematics 1 and you were well on the way with your qualifications for engineering. What did the war do within you to change the direction you were going in pre-war, please?
It did a number of things. I enjoyed my experience in the militia even before the war. I enjoyed the comradeship, the camaraderie between people of different classes. Mm. I enjoyed learning. I think I always suspected that leaders are born, they're not made. I certainly learned that out of my even pre-war experiences. I had it confirmed during the war, especially as a prisoner of war, where rank matters to some people, mattered to Black Jack Callahan, I think. It didn't matter to me. As I say, the quality is in the person, and I've quoted in addresses I've given some of the words I learned at Adelaide Tech from Henley's Invictus poem. I thank whatever gods, and it's a little g, it's not a capital, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. It's the inner strength that comes out of leadership, the awareness that certain people have obligations to care for others. Is that the sort of thing you're asking me about?
That's exactly what I'm asking you, Harry. What did the war do within you to change direction, your direction, pre-war? I mean, anybody I've ever spoken to who has been a POW had their view of humanity changed overnight, for good or bad, mostly for the latter.
Yeah, well, that's true. I got shot of my Methodism for a start. I remember the day in Bandung when I walked outside our densely packed accommodation, looked up and said, I do not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the Living God, and you can do what you bloody well like about it. Now, if he'd been Zeus, he'd hit me with a thunderbolt, but nothing did happen. My awareness came out of not just that Henley Invictus stuff, but the realisation that ultimately you're on your own. And if you... I'm probably getting a bit arrogant here, but if you are aware that you have the qualities that allow you to provide a service, you must do so. And I know ever since the war, I've tried to contribute in other activities, especially where I perceive that there are non-leaders providing fraudulent examples. We see a lot of that right now with the programming that's going on for the coming election. And bullshit does not baffle brains, but...
Does a good job of it. So, Harry, come 1946, and... Yes, you would have been repatriated in 46, I reckon. Would that be right. Yeah, yeah. Were you greatly physically weakened by your 3.5
yeah.
years?
Yeah. Yeah. It staggers me that any of us lived. As you know, 8,000 of the 24,000 died. I myself was about 6.5 stone, 40 kilos, I think, at the end of the war, about half my weight. None of us would have lived if the war had gone another year. In spite of my misgivings about the use of the atomic bomb, nevertheless, it has to be said that I and those of us who did survive as prisoners only did so because of the atomic bomb, and not just the first atomic bomb. I was very fortunate in prison camp to come across a Dutchman, engineer lieutenant Felix van Wijk, and I can pronounce the Dutch phoneme W-I-J-K, Wijk. He was brilliant. He became professor of metallography at the University of Delft in Holland after the war, died at the early age of about 50 from a heart attack. It was a familial problem. I have a book over there that you might like to see. I stole 10 foolscap leaves, and out of each leaf I made 4 pages. So that booklet, which I still have, is 40 pages of closely written pencil. We would work in the dust, and I would commit this to paper afterwards. Had to be very careful, because you weren't allowed to do anything like this, and punishment could be death if diaries and things like that were found. I was able to, behind you there, there are two books. One, Janke and Emder, Table of Functions. The other, Sir James Jean's Electricity and Magnetism. They're heavy books. I was able to show these to the Japanese, and they franked them. So I took them everywhere we went, and they used to shift us about every 3 to 4 months for reasons that I'm not too clear about. I carried these wherever I went, and I hid in those books those notes. And I got them home. I got credit at the university when I showed that stuff to Professor Kerr Grant. But as I say, was I affected? I was far too weak to take advantage of the credit that would have been given to me for having done that work. For example, they allowed me to go straight through to maths, third year maths, and I just couldn't do it. It took me about 2 years, I think, to recover.
Yeah.
But after about 2 years, I was all right and could get pretty active again. I never had any post-traumatic stress disorder. That's an invention out of the Korean War, and it's been promoted further out of Vietnam. And did you ever know Les Poydevin?
Very well.
Okay. You've read Samurais and Circumcision?
I have.
Well, he says there that there were no psychiatric problems arising from the war with us. From the time of the first beheading, and beheadings are a bit unfunny, I can tell you. From the time of the first beheading, you know that, well, in Henley's terms, that you are the master of your fate, you're the captain of your soul. You know that. You know that you have to survive. Now, if you don't have those qualities, you'll die. And it's strange. We would never look at someone and say they're going to die, but when they did, you knew that had to happen, and this compulsive hand washing and other signs are indicative of an existing mental, perhaps disorder even, that won't allow you to get through. I mean, it's Well, it's impossible to describe the conditions. I have that Veterans Affairs booklet there about lifelong captives. But if you sit down and lament it, and say, you've got to get onto something. I got onto that, and I applied myself independent of... In fact, I'm one of them anyway, when we got home, we were quickly given a 20% pension without asking for it. Without asking for anything, it was raised subsequently to 40%. Well, I was about 67, I think, when these things started to revisit me.
This is your leg.
Yeah. Mm. It's a post-beriberi neuropathy. And same with my hands a bit. There was then a little bit of trouble with Veterans Affairs because we'd left them alone, and I think they just wished we'd go away. But that wasn't to be. I've spent a lot of my life back in Southeast Asia because I estimate that it took Asians about 6 months to realise that the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere of the Japanese was just a neo-colonialism. Asian and not European, but worse than the Dutch. I mean, they treated the Indonesians much worse than the Dutch. And at the end of the war, when they had, I was one of those, they had working on the docks at Tanjung Priok in Batavia. They're being bombed by the Royal Australian Air Force. I've been bombed a lot by the Royal Australian Air Force. I tell you, they're pretty rotten shots, which is just as well. But at that stage, there were people just dying in the streets. We'd walk through to the docks, dying with malnutrition. And I felt an obligation to Indonesians who, of whatever ethnicity, would give us succour. SUCCOUR, not the other succour. Give us succour, and I set up physics departments there. So I've had things to do. I've been lucky, Rob. I think I've had things to do, and I just returned to that post-traumatic stress disorder. On the ship coming home from Singapore, it's a hospital ship, and there were those Sumatra nurses, including Vivian Bullwinkle, yes, sole survivor of the Banker Island massacre. All of a sudden, we hear over the tannoy or whatever they call that loudspeaker thing that you prisoners of war should not feel ashamed or guilty for having capitulated. And you think, hell, I'm the one who's been betrayed. So I just returned to Poitevin in writing, as agreed with what I have said, that if you have that inner strength, you can survive those things. You have to survive them, or as I say, if you don't survive them, you'll die.
Mm. So Harry, 1946, under the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme, you may have been offered a whole range of things. How did you decide on what you wanted to do then in further education?
Well, I knew what I wanted to do because of the stimulation I'd had from Felix. So I wanted to switch from electrical engineering to mathematics and physics. And I was reasonably good at it too, I thought. So why not have a go? So that's how I changed to mathematics and physics. And I either came top or second of every subject I did, so... And there's a little bit of arrogance, I suppose, about satisfaction. I know when I did honours in 1951, I felt so confident of getting first class honours that and I'd be married then. My wife and I just went to Kangaroo Island. And just forgot all about it until the results came out. In those days, of course, the results used to be published in the Advertiser.
Yeah.
We had doubled. As I said earlier, the university was the home of the perhaps idle rich before the war, and when the ex-service students came in 1946, we doubled the student population to about 4,700. So it was everybody knew everybody. Diana Walker, who became my wife, was the lead comic in the 1948 review. I was the stage manager, and we got married. She married me, actually. I'll digress again a bit. I'm one of those who I read Darwin and Huxley and those people during the war. I'm one of those who supported Darwin's thesis that in the gender race, it's the female that does the selecting. Alfred Russel Wallace had been to South America, and he wrote the Santabong paper in Santabong in Sarawak in 1854, 5 years before Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859, and it was Russell who first proposed the evolution of species. And he coined the phrase, the survival of the fittest. But as a result of his work in South America and in New Guinea, where he watched bower birds and birds of paradise displaying themselves, he thought that it was the males that did the selecting. Darwin argued the other, that it's the dowdy female who actually calls the shots. In my own personal, I don't expect you to write this up, but in my own personal case, I was the vice president of the SRC. After a couple of years, I got fit and so I started to get active. I became the vice president of the Students' Representative Council. Diana Walker was the president of the Women's Union. She was the first non-college girl ever to be president of an Adelaide Women's Union. We met at the first meeting of the SRC in October of 1948. They used to live at Albert Park. She had a sister, Babs, who worked in the State Library. And in those days, if you took a girl home, you had to take her all the way home, not stick her on a bus. And anyway, they lived at Albert Park, so they went down there in the train. He lived at Unley Park, so the lights go out, all the traffic stops, and the lights go out at 1:45. You'd have to walk home. Anyway, he's in there in their house with Babs, and in comes Dottie, and she announced, "I've just met the most gorgeous man, Harry Medlin, and I'm going to marry him." Now, this is October 1948. January 49, we get engaged. June 49, we get married. So, and I've told this to Dottie's friends and women, and they all confess that they did the selecting. So I don't know where you stand, but you might think about it.
I was selected, Harry. Harry, can you tell me a bit about the university place? And I don't just mean the geography. In 1946, you were talking about Professor Kerr Grant earlier. Well, he to me seems to have been a larger-than-life character. Barbara Kidman's told me that not all his experiments worked very well, but she said he was definitely a character. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. He was hopeless. he was a fascinating fellow. He became... When Bragg went back to England in 1909, Kerr Grant became acting head, and I think it was 1911 before he was made head. He'd done some work in Melbourne, some very very demanding work on. Balances, Now, in the Bragg Centenary, I set up a museum there, and we had Kerr Grant's actual torsion balance in there. I don't know where it is now, they shifted it. But that's probably the only real research work that he ever did. He wrote, however, some fascinating articles. University professors had an article each Saturday in the Advertiser.
Yeah.
And I've got copies here of some of them. One of them is Kerr Grant's Things Not Attempted Yet. Have you ever seen it?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
Fascinating. So he was a thoughtful person without being an experimental physicist. He had a reader there, Roy Burden, Dr. Burden, who was an experimental physicist and did very high quality research work on surface tension, particularly of mercury. Gordon Aitchison was a younger experimentalist, radio atmospheric stuff. George Fuller, who was I think opening bat for South Australia and played state baseball. But Kerr Grant, Cleft palate was something else. When I did my honours there, we used to have scientific German with Kerr Grant, and we'd read in German scientific stuff. I did a bit of German in prison camp, but I didn't like the language. But I can read scientific German. Because the words essentially anyway in physics are not all that different. He was loved by his students. He always gave the Physics One lectures, and the last Physics One lecture was always attended by everybody. And he used to drop weights, and he'd have a pot you could catch him in, they'd shift it, and he'd know they'd shift it, so he'd shift it to the wrong place, and the damn thing would crash into the floor. Dardy did honours organic chemistry with Macbeth, and Macbeth had a son and twin daughters.
Mm-hmm.
The twin daughters might still be around, I'm not too sure. Anyway, one day the phone rang at home, and Dighty tells me that Kerr Grant said, Kerr Grant, I bet you wouldn't know who it was otherwise. And he said, I have to propose the toast at the marriage of one of the Macbeth. And he said, I'd like some background. So she provided him with this background. I was patron of the Science Association, and we always used to get him to come to the meetings, and he'd recite If.
Yes.
Have you got the last verse of If?
Oh, I have at home, yes.
Yeah.
This is Rudyard Kipling's poem. Yeah.
You'll be a man, my son. Yeah. Yeah.
So despite his ineptness, if that's the word, at experimentation, Harry, he was a much loved character, was he?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. He was adored. So many stories. A bloke like you ought to collect the Kerr Grant stories. Or have you done it?
No, I haven't even started that yet, Harry.
Oh.
I have a few from Barbara and other people.
Well, it's the famous one where, you know, he had a Stanley steam car.
No, I didn't know that. I know what a Stanley steam car is.
Yeah, I think he had the only Stanley steam car in South Australia. And he rang the police one day and said, look, it's been stolen. He said, my car's been stolen. Oh. They said, well, what's the number? What's its number, Kerr Grant, Professor? He said, oh. He said, oh, I'll go outside and have a look and tell you. That's one of them.
Because I noticed in a very famous book of cartoons that Kerwin McGrath, the Advertiser cartoonist, did in the 30s, Cur Grant features on nearly every page as a fireman and as a policeman and as something else.
I've got that book down below.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was obviously one of those people much revered, but I mean, could he actually teach, Harry?
Hmm?
Could he actually teach?
No, no. He took us. Oh, God. He took us for third year electromagnetism. Have you done any electromagnetism?
No, I have not.
No, okay. I gave my honours seminar on the electromagnetic field tensor. It's beautiful. It's a 4x4 tensor, and it describes the whole of electromagnetism, gives all the Maxwell's laws of radiation. Now, there are two parts of an electromagnetic field, the electric field and the magnetic field. Now, the electric field is controlled by a free vector, right? It's just a free vector. I won't go into the mathematics of it, but the magnetic field is not a free vector. It's a revolving vector. So the electromagnetic field that goes along a wire is rotating. So these people who worry about what might be the effect on school children of these high tension lines, they're pretty sensible to be concerned about this. And if you look at, when I was an apprentice, I worked as the technical assistant to the country line superintendent, Arthur Fielding, who was a captain in the artillery and got killed in Tobruk. And if you look at the high tension lines, you'll find that they rotate and reverse, and they call it halting, reversing, barreling. And they do that to break up the magnetic field. Well, anyway, Kerr Grant was lecturing it, and he was absolutely hopeless. Now, there's a relationship in electromagnetism. It's gamma squared mu naught epsilon c squared is equal to 1. Now, that's a dimensionless number. Mu naught is the permeability constant of a magnetic field. Epsilon naught is the permittivity constant of the electric field. You cannot take an arbitrary system of units in this universe in which we live and do with it as you like. So gamma is given different values. In electrostatic units, gamma is 1 over epsilon naught, so mu naught c squared is equal to 1. In the MKS system of units, gamma is arbitrarily taken to be 1, right? Mm-hmm. So mu naught epsilon naught c squared is, and there's nothing you can do about it. The permittivity constant is going to be the square of the velocity of light divided by the permeability. It's weird. We're stuck with it. Well, do you think Kerr Grant understood that? He had no idea. And he gives, for example, B equals mu H. B, H is the field strength and B is the induction. B is mu H. Now, sometimes it would be B equals mu H, and sometimes it would be B equals mu H divided by 4 pi. Now, how can you... Oh, God. Did Barbara tell you about... Oh, my parrots, aren't they beautiful?
Mm.
Yeah. Did Barbara tell you about his first-year physics exam in 1945?
Yes, I think she did, but I'm just trying to recall what it was. She told me a number of things. Now, what was that one?
Well, I can tell you. I wasn't here, but she has told me, and so has a friend of mine, Wren Potts, Wren Keats. He became Professor of Mathematics in Newcastle, Wren Keats. He set him a grating equation. This is a grating rule, and you got light of a certain wavelength. What is the angle of the third order of diffraction? Now, it comes out to be sine theta, 2d sine theta is n lambda. It gave the wavelength and the grating spacing and all that stuff. Turned out that the angle, arc sine theta, was 1.3. Now, sine can never be greater than 1. You know, sine goes from 0 to 1. And, of course, the better students worried that, they thought, I must have this. Anyway, those who didn't know what they were talking about just said arc sine 1.3. Now, there's no angle the sine of which is 1.3. So Anyway, that's one of the Kerr Grant.
So, Harry, at the university at that time, were there other people like Kerr Grant who had the same type of mystique in the eyes of the students?
I don't think. No, I think he was. I think he was unique. There were people like Mawson, of course, surrounding whom there was certainly a mystique. But I think that apart from Reg Sprigg, I doubt if anybody loved Mawson, even Paquita.
I don't think we'll go down that road, Harry. Yeah, Reg Sprigg was very fond of him, there was no doubt about
Yeah.
that. But was he a quite was Mawson quite austere?
Well, to me, he was. Have you interviewed Roald Twitole?
No, I have not.
Oh, in writing about Mawson, I think you'd probably have to, because Twitole and a couple of others, I've got his paper down below somewhere in the Royal Society of South Australia, wrote about Madigan.
Yes.
Now, I knew Madigan because when we lived at Blackwood, the Madigans lived at
Yes.
Blackwood. Even though I knew Madigan, I was unaware of the existence even of Russell Tully Madigan. I became aware of him when I was a corporal in the Royal Australian Engineers, and he joined up as a sapper, and he was in my platoon, and he subsequently became Sir Russell Madigan, of course. And was a bit irritated that Adelaide University wouldn't give him a Doctor of Science. I think Reg Sprigg failed to get a Doctor of Science in Adelaide too.
Oh dear.
He got an honorary Doctor of Science at ANU. But I had Reg Sprigg as a sapper. I think he was the second worst, or perhaps even the worst, sapper soldier I ever had. He one of those blokes who could walk along swinging the wrong hand. They're funny.
So, were you ever taught by C.T. Madigan
No,
yourself? No.
no.
Was he still in the department when you were a student, or had he left by then?
No, I think he was still there at the end of the war. I think both he and Mawson. Yeah. There was a relationship between Mawson and Madigan, like the relationship between Kerr Grant and Burdon. But anyway, if you're writing any more about Mawson, I think you ought to see Roald at
Oh no, that was a very good idea, Harry.
Twitole.
I understood that the relation between Madigan and Mawson may have been very stretched indeed, and that they did not get on well at all. I'm not sure if that's correct.
Well, that's certainly what Twitole says in this. I think there are a couple of other authors, Twitole and a few others, perhaps. Not too sure who they'd be. Anyway, they decided to coexist at arm's length, I think. Their personalities were so different. There's a story about Madigan you might not have heard. We adored him as kids at Blackwood, and he'd come along and he'd talk to the kids in the Methodist Church about his expeditions into the Simpson Desert or whatever. Anyway, he was away on one of these expeditions. We came back. What were they called? They own Watunga.
Ashby's.
Yeah, Ashby. Eric Ashby?
Eric, yes.
Yeah. Sir?
No, I
No,
don't
okay.
think so.
Eric Ashby. He had a sort of Mellors, Mellors,
Yes.
the gardener and
Yep.
Lady Chatterley's lover. He had this fellow. Now, Ashbys were supposed to be Quakers, as I understand it. Now, as kids, we used to hunt in their orchard. Right? Brighton Parade,
Yeah.
you come across the railway line, get in the back of the orchard. You have to be very careful because this Mellors, we didn't call him Mellors at the time, as kids we didn't know about Lady Chatterley, but anyway, they had saltpeter guns. Now, you'd get shot with saltpeter if he could catch it. But we used to hunt in packs of three. There was my brother and me and one other fella. And one would keep knit, and the other two would ride the orchard. Anyway, this fella is probably the bloke who shot Madigan's dog. Madigan was on an expedition, came back, and his dog had been shot. So, you know, their house in Cliff Street or whatever that street is, was just about opposite Wootunga, and he went over and knocked on Ashby's door and said, "Did you shoot my dog?" And Ashby said yes, and Madigan King hit him. Well, I mean, stories like that among kids is, you never forget.
So before you even went to university, Harry, you had stories about these people that you'd picked up in your youth. Yeah,
sure.
And I guess Adelaide was small enough then in population terms that you knew the stories about Mawson or Madigan that you'd picked up, and I'm not saying they were necessarily heroes, but they had some status in your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So how did you fare at university yourself, though, Harry, in terms of the course you took up?
Well, I had to be careful. As I say, I'd been given some credit. I did finish my pass course in 3 years, but in 1946 and 47, I had, you know, reduced load, probably about two-thirds. I got all the results downstairs. I could find out the actual things, but I had to take it easy. For the first 2 years, but by the third year, I was doing a full load, and I wanted to acquit myself, as I thought I was acquittable. Mm-hmm. So I didn't overstretch. In fact, that's not quite true, because in the third year, I wanted to overload. Yeah, I did. There were two third-year physics subjects, physics 3A and physics 3B. I did 3A in 1947, but I still had chemistry and statistical methods and third-year mathematics to catch up, so I had a full year's load. But there was this physics 3B, which was an experimental thing. I think there were 23 experiments, and I wanted to do it. In those days, if you overloaded, you had to get permission. You have to now. It's a lot more difficult. Anyway, I went to see Harry Wesley Smith, who was our guidance officer, and said, "I'd like to overload." And he said, "Go down and see Joe." Now, Joe was Professor Joe Wood. He was Dean of the Faculty of Science at the time, Professor of Botany. So I went down to the botany department. There's Joe in the lab with his sleeves rolled up, and I said, "I'm Harry Medlin, and I've been sent by Harry Wesley Smith to get your permission to overload by doing an extra half year's work." So I did a year and a half's work in 1948 by overloading. I didn't need it to get the degree. Anyway. And he said, "How have you been going?" And I said, "Oh, I've been going all right. Wasn't too fit for a couple of years, but I'm all right now. And been getting either first or second in all my subjects." And he said, "If you don't hear anything, it's all right." Now, when I think of what you'd have to go through now, yeah, all the humbug and brouhaha, and anyway, I heard nothing, so I did it, and came second in that. We Yeah, there were 23 experiments, and we did them all in the first two terms. Do you know how?
No.
We used to break into the physics building at night, and if you look at the physics building, the windows have got those flaps on.
Yes,
them.
Yeah.
And we used to make sure the flaps were not locked, right? And so we, oh God, we get in there and work until midnight or something, ride home on a bike, and got it all finished by the end of the second term. There were just Michael Iliff. You ever heard of him?
No.
Yeah, he was in charge of this course.
This is Aylifffe.
Aylifffe, I think.
Yeah.
Something. He had a daughter who got, in fact, I presided, gave her a degree. We had to come down from the States because she was in a wheelchair. She's a severe spastic or something. And he worried terribly about this, and his wife was a nurse. And there were terrible stories about him after he retired. He started beating up his wife.
Mm.
And I think he felt a bit guilty with us ex-service students because he was old enough to have been involved and just didn't get involved. Yeah, Mick Iliff. He wondered how we'd been able to finish these experiments. So there were no caretakers in those days. And we'd get in there, put the lights on, and
fantastic.
Dear idea.